Welcome back to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 320. It's the very first episode of 2013. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
My tongue is all swollen.
And James Jones.
This week, we're going to do your top 100 games of all times, but here are a lot of really antiquated rules.
You'll notice John Lindemann is not with us, but he is expected to be here next week. He told me we're going to record on the 10th of January, my birthday, and for my birthday, what I wanted was some sweet, sweet John Lindemann.
Oh, no!
So we're hoping to have him on the next episode and thereafter, permanently, or indefinitely is probably a better word for it. But,
so yes. How long have we been sans John?
It's been like 4 months, I feel like.
It feels like a lifetime.
It feels like it probably about half the time that Guillaume's been on the show.
Pretty much, yeah.
Coincidence?
Like, Guillaume and John haven't developed the same bond that the rest of us have. So we got to work on that.
I don't have bonds with Jonathan Lindemann. that is entirely miscategorizing our relationship.
I'm so excited to get him back on here.
And I am going to wreck it when he gets back.
And, you know, when we had him on the telethon a couple months ago, we didn't really get to talk about the stuff he's been playing. And I don't know that he's been playing very much. I know he's been working his ass off at his job. But I'm sure he's got a few things to tell us about. So I'm looking forward to catching up with him. But anyway, we have a pretty typical episode this week. It's going to be new business. We're going to talk about some of the stuff we played over the holidays, of course. And coming up after the break, we've got your listener mail. And from there, the rest of January gets a lot crazier.
Let's get crazy! Yeah, so I, unlike the rest of the people, or almost everyone on Earth, I didn't get time off over the holidays, so I'm a little bit bitter. I didn't get to play a lot of big games, so my experiences are much more confined. One of the first games I played over the holiday was Crimson Shroud on the 3DS, made by my personal savior. I don't mean Jesus. I mean the creators of the Ogre Battle franchise. This game, obviously, Guillaume spoke about a couple weeks ago. He actually reviewed it for the site. It is a, for those of you who missed out on the previous installments, it is a sort of a simulation of playing an actual pen and paper RPG. The game's narrator is actually like the game master of the game. It's written as if someone is telling you the story as you go through rooms. Like it literally is things like you enter the room and there is a rank smell in the air, things like that. And all the figurines are actual figurines with bases, and when you knock them over, the level 5 logo is on the bottom. It's tremendously amazing.
So good.
They don't aim it at all. They are figure ass reens. There is a Penny Arcade comic about it to talk about how grandular this game is, and I've never agreed with one more, which is, do you want a game that's so grandular you get things like rings with +2 defense to orcs? It's in here. There's stuff like that in this game. It is stat-heavy, off-the-wall, crazy good game. What's interesting about the mechanics is you don't level up any. What you get is you get increasingly good gear to increase your stats, so you just keep stacking things on your character, and you build your character that way. You do get skills, but your stats don't go up, not naturally, which is kind of an interesting thing to go through. It means grinding isn't usually a great strategy, although sometimes you get better gear. It's a very, very narrative heavy game. It's remarkably well written, although occasionally poorly Englished. I'm trying to think if it was You Harve the Surprise or something like that. I'm like, well, that's odd. The music is tremendously, as I called it, sumptuous. I mean, lavish beyond what it has any reason to be in a game that was part of Guilds 01. And it's just tremendously fun. I just really, really enjoy the hell out of this game. At the moment, I'm not enjoying the hell out of this game because I'm stuck fighting some enemies that look like you, which is really annoying, and I can't kill them. But beyond that, I've been having a great time.
So did you get stuck at the same part that I did? Like, did it take you forever to gain the item to get through that one room?
It didn't take me long because I was sort of waiting for it, and then I realized, oh, this is the spot they were talking about.
Okay.
And there's only – on the map, you can actually see tiny little feet walking around in areas where there's going to be fights if you go in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And there was only one area around that had the little feet stomping around, so I figured that had to be where it was. And I just – it took a couple fights, and then I got it.
Yeah, but there's still feet stomping around in the previous area that you were in. So when you don't know actually what you're supposed to be doing, like what I did was I went back and refought all those old fights.
I agree. It's obtuse as hell. I just happened to have enough pre-knowledge to figure it out with the information I had available to me. The current boss battle I'm stuck on is far more of a bane to my existence than anything else. But it's a really interesting and surprisingly deep game for what it's split about a 5-hour game, I guess.
Yeah, I would say so.
There's a new game plus mode on top of that. I'm at about 4.5, and just beating my head against a wall. So hopefully I'll get through that soon. But if I have to restart, God, I hope not. It's not too long.
You're really at the toughest fight in the whole game.
Is that the toughest fight in the game?
It is.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's brutal. But getting through that, I'm really enjoying the game. It's really a masterpiece. It's kind of amazing how much quality was packed into the Guild Wars 1 package. I mean, Liberation Maiden isn't a great game, but for me, it was one of the games I enjoyed the most this year. Aeroporter is supposed to be good, despite being, well, what it is. It's Aeroporter. And this game is just stunning. I mean, I'm really looking forward to the last game in the package, the one where you're a merchant. This is kind of an amazing collection of titles, and it really is a testament to what Level 5 was able to accomplish. And I'm really excited they're making another one of these Guild series.
Yeah, and I was just so shocked by just how much I was enjoying Crimson Shroud. And it's really such a shame that it had this one big flaw that I had to acknowledge, because otherwise, like, they were knocking it out of the park. I would have given it my highest recommendation, but no, there's this huge, huge glaring flaw that, you know, there's no way around it. Like, this is a big problem.
What's funny is at this point, if you Google Crimson Shroud, one of the auto suggestions is the room in question. where the door's locked and you can't figure out how to open the stupid thing. It's like one of the first responses.
Nice.
People just have no idea how to solve it.
Yeah.
I've already personally been responsible for at least 3 sales of this game. I mean, people I know who love people who made the games behind these series, I've basically been going like, dude, buy it right now. I mean, if you like that kind of game, you'll be in good shape. I mean, I know some people who at least when they were younger used to play D&D, and if they had 3DSs, I would probably tell them you need to get this game. It's simplified, but not in that it's not granular stat crazy town, because the stats are absolutely out of insane levels of detail. It's more that the whole experience from the player standpoint is much more streamlined. A lot of times in the game, the characters will stop. You know, you're walking around in the different rooms, and they'll stop. And well, my favorite part is they'll have these like dramatic pans, like they're panning to someone who's talking in a movie, but they're just standing dead still while while the narrator says what they said. And like the narrator will say, like, you hear, or one of your characters has the ability to literally see scents, as in smells. You can see them. And he goes, he'll just get stopped dead and be like, "Whoa, stop! I smell something." There's lots of little cues that the game puts in there. It's really a tight experience. I'm really happy with it. Like Guillaume said, there is this one flaw that is absolutely befuddling that it made its way in there. But beyond that, I really cannot. Honestly, I'm just shocked this game is just a random title on the eShop. I mean, it's it really is a great game. I'm constantly just stunned by it. I mean, when I got it, Somebody had asked me if it was good. I'm like, I just bought it. I'll tell you tomorrow. I figured I'll play it like an hour and let him know. I looked up. It was like 3.5 hours later. I'm like, well, shit. Okay. You win, game. You win. What I will say, though, although it's all written from this sort of third-person omniscient, like, it's like, basically, it's like someone is telling you a story from a storybook. And in fact, the whole game is being told ex post facto. The whole plot of the story is being told by someone. they do still do a really good job developing the characters, even though you're just getting quotes. You're not getting real conversations. I was kind of surprised at how the characters developed. I mean, you don't learn a whole lot about them. You get the option to, at certain points, reminisce, which is an option. You can do it, about the various interaction between these characters. But, I mean, ultimately, the game doesn't give you a lot to work with, but still does a pretty good job painting these pictures of who they are.
Yeah, and that's kind of the way that I prefer my RPGs. If I had to compare games like Final Fantasy IV, where, you know, the characters only emote by jumping or having, like, three different facial expressions, or, you know, compare that to Final Fantasy XIII, in which the acting is so very, very, very Japanese that it's off-putting, you know, like, in my mind, the Final Fantasy IV characters will feel more real to me, because I'm not putting, you know, things that are off-putting. You know, I'm not giving them mannerisms that I don't understand or that don't seem to fit them. And it's kind of the same case here. Like, when you let your imagination fill in the gaps, there's nothing really taking you out of it.
Yes. So, over the show's break. So, as a real quick one-off, one of the games I picked up on the Steam, on a previous Steam sale, it was in one of the packs I got. I had no intention of ever actually playing the thing. It's called Universal Sandbox. I was a bit disappointed with this sale. Not hugely, just a little bit. And didn't really buy much. But I pulled this game out of my download shelf because I figured, whatever, let's give it a shot. It's a giant-ass physics simulator where you can simulate everything from planetary systems to, like, galaxies orbiting one another, based on this relatively complicated physics engine that you can render in real time. So you can create like a solar system. You just drop a star, you set all the size, the heat, you know, where it is in the life cycle of a star, how big it is, how dense it is, how much heat it's generating. You put planets of varying description, size, composition, densities around its orbit. You can put things in orbit around the planet and just set it off, and then you can speed up the game clock and just watch it go. You could do completely asinine things like put the Earth on orbit and put another Earth in its path, put a couple more Earths in there, and create your own Mayan 2012 scenario. I mean, it's kind of fun to watch physics go nuts, like when you put a second sun in the solar system. You just decide, screw it, we're putting the sun out in the middle of the solar system, right out somewhere around Saturn, and just watch planets get shot off into space because they're in competing gravity wells. It's really kind of a neat experience. I really enjoyed doing it. And it's kind of a neat opportunity to just sort of experiment with physics. From an educational standpoint, or kind of how I played this game, it's like doing experiments on a scale that no one could ever possibly do them. You know, what happens if you put two galaxies right next to each other? Well, they completely screw each other up. That's pretty much what happens. But if you put two suns, they'll never run into each other because they keep pushing each other away at certain points. But every planet in that solar system is screwed. Trying to do things like creating systems where the planets manage to actually impact one another and watching the resulting effect. It's just kind of a fun experience to play around with, and you can actually learn a little bit about physics from how it all works, and you can see some of the terminology, and you can understand how planets orbit stars, how stars come into being, stuff like that.
Well, in a lot of very, very open sandbox games like that, you know, SimCity and the like, there's, you know, open gameplay, but there's also scenarios. Is there anything like that?
Yeah, there's a handful of scenarios the game throws at you to try out. Just a little bit of stuff, like it'll say, go ahead and give Earth a moon as big as Earth. See what happens. Well, if you can't figure it out, bad shit happens. That's what happens if Earth has a moon as big as Earth. It goes to hell pretty quick. Or it'll be like, put another planet between Mercury and Venus. Guess how that goes? Not well. Not well for that other planet. Does not go particularly well for Mercury or Venus either. Because I think one of them got ejected into the sun. So, I mean, it's got things like that. It'll have stuff about, like, galactic level, you know, like, so you've got two galaxies, Some of them is just watch how they interplay with one another. Some of them it's like try to stabilize these galaxies. You know, you've got two that are orbiting each other, but they're all elliptical because they keep ejecting themselves. It's so you're trying to manipulate the gravity around them with other objects. It's kind of a neat, but it's a relatively minor part. Really, it's just the opportunity to play around with stuff. It's not dissimilar to like the old rocket game for like really old Apple LC2s, where you had to build a rocket from various components and then test it out and see how it worked, and pretty much always blew up on the launch pad unless you had the exact right combination. In this case, you're pretty much always going to wreck a solar system unless you get it exactly right.
Well, Korbel Space Program is like that too, and that's I think that's free for PCs.
Yeah, there's. I just remember that game as a kid where you'd put like, oh, I'm going to put the biggest engine on the smallest rocket and see what happens. Oh god.
That's exactly what Korbel Space Program is. It's just a modern version of it.
Nice.
You
should have to go.
But
what have
James,
I done?
Did you ever play Orbient on WiiWare?
I did not.
You might like it if you like this, because it's more gamey by far.
Yeah.
But it's similar concepts, you know, very easy to grasp, but always interesting to watch how things play out, you know?
Yeah. I think it's kind of almost a Garry's Mod situation here, where you just set things up and hit go and just watch what you hath wrought. I mean,
but does it just render orbits, or do you see, like, can you see tides? Can you see planets just being crushed by gravity, or?
So it's way zoomed out, so you can't, not that I've been able to see, you can zoom in to see orbits. I did realize that I wiped out all life on Earth by putting a second sun. It got really hot. I had a situation where I really badly screwed up Mars's orbit, and eventually it slammed into Venus, and then you ended up with this big ejected mass, and like a really big Venus. So there's a certain extent, but you can't really measure effect on things like tides down at the micro level. It's really more of just like a, hey, physics is fun, kids, than anything. But I mean, I could see, you know, showing this to kids and letting them see it, and they would understand how stuff is working maybe better than just trying to explain to them how gravity holds planets in orbit.
I would have liked to have this when I took some orbital mechanics classes in college, because that stuff, the basics aren't too hard to visualize, but
right.
You get deeper and deeper into it. And once you get into in-body equations and stuff, you know, where you've got all these different things in space and they're all attracting each other,
yes,
different, you know, to different degrees. And if you perturb one, what happens to the others? It becomes really hard to kind of keep track of it in your head, and this would be a great tool.
That's basically all this
to kind
is
of
doing.
Set that up and just you know, watch it play.
Yeah, it is always fun to just put suns orbiting planets, and just watch it all go to hell eventually, because it'll like hold stable for millions of years, and then eventually just something snaps,
yep,
and then just everything goes to crap in about 1,000 years. You're like, well, for a million years, shit was great on this Earth, and not so much.
All right, and what is this program called?
It's called Universe Sandbox.
The Universe Sandbox.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's one of the indie games on Steam. It's probably like a dollar.
Yeah, sounds cool.
Yeah.
All right, so Guillaume is up next with new business.
Yeah, so I went for the holidays. I thought, okay, I've got a lot of driving to do, a lot of family to see. There's probably not going to be a lot of time for gaming. Should I bring the Wii U? Is that a good idea? Of course it's a good idea. So I brought the Wii U with me, and I did manage to get some Nintendo Land time in with some friends and with various people. And one of the first few games that I tried with friends was Mario Chase, which is not a complicated game. And it's still as fun as it was when I played the demo back, you know, 2 E3s ago. But I don't know, like it's hard to understand what makes it so much fun and what makes it so stressful. You're there, you're hiding from your friends, and you're just, you know, oh my God, they're going to see me. And the elation that you get just from standing in a corner and them passing by you without turning around, without seeing you, is a feeling that's not really matched by many other video games, I find. It's so much fun. But then, I don't know, like the game does, Nintendo Land games in general give you pretty good instructions at the beginning, but they omit small stuff that normally I think I would notice by myself. But it takes more time to notice when you're playing with friends because you're just, you know, you're busy trying to have fun. And one of the features of this game is that they see you, they show you the distance at which the person you're looking for is, which completely screws up my early strategies in the game. I would, you know, I would try to hide behind, you know, a kind of a bush or a part of the scenery and hope that the other guys wouldn't see me. And at some point, someone realized, oh, shit, like, I can see I'm getting closer here. The number of yards is getting smaller and smaller. And all of a sudden, you know, you can't just hide behind, duck behind something anymore. You really have to constantly run and run and run.
So were you playing with the maximum of three, or did you have some of those bastard Yoshis in there?
Yoshis? No, no, we were three. And then we were four. I never got a game of five playing, but with three, you don't get Yoshis.
Yeah, the Yoshis are actually, they actually ruin that strategy pretty thoroughly because they're really fast. And they basically just buzz around the level until they see you, and then you're never going to lose them. Then it just becomes to escape me.
We had fun with that. And then with one of my friends whom I played a lot of Left 4 Dead with, we started playing the Metroid minigame, which was surprisingly fun. I played as the ship, and he and his fiance were playing as they were on foot. We immediately went for the co-op missions because that's what we mostly like in this type of game. We weren't really competing against each other because I really feel like the ship is a little bit too overpowered for against even a team of people on foot. So yeah, we were collaborating, and it can lead to some pretty great moments. There's not a whole lot of variety in the missions. There's a lot of kill all enemies types of missions, but some of the best missions were you have to find tokens with your Mii's faces on them. Only the person who matches the token can pick it up. And so the arenas can be pretty damn big, and it becomes just, you know, a challenge for, you have to make sure that everyone in the team finds all of their tokens. And you have a very limited time in order to make that happen. So our strategies very quickly became, I would scour the whole level with a ship because I was the fastest and I could, you know, gain elevation very easily. And I would tell people, okay, so on the top floor, you have this token. On the second floor from the top, you have these tokens. And then people would just go off. Or sometimes, since people on foot can latch on to your ship while you fly, then like they would just hitch a ride and I would lead them to the tokens. And that was the only way that we could finish some of the missions. Like towards the end, it became really, really challenging. And very quickly, in maybe about 2 hours, 2 hours and a half, we finished the 20 missions. You unlock harder ones after that. I think it, you know, they repeat, but they're harder. We were kind of gamed out at that point, so we stopped, but it was a lot of fun. And I kind of wish that they didn't live in Toronto, 6 hours away, so that we could complete the hard missions. But, yeah, tons of fun. And I, you know, like Nintendo Land, just from based on that experience, is really a strong, strong multiplayer game. But, you know, it's an experience that I won't get to have very often, unfortunately.
I still haven't gotten to play any multiplayer Nintendo Land, not at home at least, not since E3.
Yeah, I did for the first time during the break, and it was kind of an interesting experience watching somebody who's a traditional core gamer go through the learning process versus someone who isn't. I mean, some of the games are obviously more gamey than others, and those are the ones that one took to, and then other ones are the ones the other did, you know, like... The Luigi's Mansion one was kind of a nice middle ground because conceptually everybody gets it, but it's basically just a more complicated version of Chase Me, effectively.
Well, but you have more insight because it's from the top down.
Yeah, you do. But I mean, it bears a lot of things in common.
Yeah, I was surprised by like the Metroid game. I mean, my friend's fiance, I didn't know her like to play a lot of first person shooters, but she picked it up pretty quickly. I mean, she plays stuff like Civilization, but, you know, she never played Left 4 Dead with us, so I have no idea how easy normally it is for people to pick up those controls. She had an easier time than my brother did, so I don't know what that means. And yeah, like one of the problems I think with the controls when you're on foot, when you're using the nunchuck and Wiimotes, is that you absolutely have to hold the A button to move your view around. It's like, I think that was one of the, like, what was it called? Like the beginner controls in Metroid Prime 3 or something like that.
You suck and controls.
Except that you could actually switch to advanced in that game, and in Nintendo Land you can't. So that's a little bit disappointing. You don't have that kind of restriction when you're using the ship. You have the two sticks and you have the gyro and you have no other help. You know, like you don't, there's no, you don't have the training wheels at all. But with the Wiimote,
I was going to say, isn't the ship pretty hard to control?
We didn't switch controls. I guess that from mission to mission we could have switched, but they didn't really want to, and I didn't really want to. So I don't know. I got pretty comfortable with the controls. They can be very precise, especially thanks to the gyro. So yeah, I didn't really have any issues. But you know, I didn't let anyone else who play fewer video games try them. So I don't know how easy they are to pick up for other people. So yeah, that was basically my Nintendo Land experience. I played then, you know, with my family and with my brother and his wife, and they, you know, Mario Chase they liked, and that's mostly what we stuck with. We tried a little bit Animal Crossing Sweet Day, and we just mentioned, but they didn't really seem to enjoy it as much, and I'm not sure why. It seemed like only Mario Chase really struck a chord with them. But then again, like they tire out pretty quickly from playing video games. They're less gamers than my friends were. So,
well, I'm pretty jealous that you got to have those experiences. I didn't take my Wii U home because I was flying, and that thing, I'm so skittish about it right now, you know, that I didn't want a chance trying to take it across the country and get it banged up. And I was on such a long trip that I just decided it'll have to happen another time.
Yeah. My girlfriend actually got New Super Mario Brothers 2 as a Christmas present. So I finally got to enjoy some Mario multiplayer on the 3DS. It is a wretched experience.
It is really.
It is only fun insofar as like playing a game cooperatively is inherently fun. But it is terrible in the way that it's executed. The best way that I can describe it is we've all played Sonic the Hedgehog 2 on the Genesis, right? And, you know, the second player could pick up the second controller and control Tails, who was basically invincible and who could jump around the screen, but would not affect the camera in any way and would jump in and out of the view.
Would derive no joy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, picture that. It's exactly the same, except that this time, Tails can actually lose power-ups, you know, get it hit, even when, you know, a little bit off-screen. And that's basically the NSMB2 multiplayer experience. It is, I don't understand it, you know. Like, it is so much less enjoyable than the console games. You have this very, very, very cramped view. The screen doesn't stretch in any way. The camera doesn't zoom out. Even though each player has their own screen, they can't really separate. They both see the exact same field of gameplay.
That's so dumb.
Yeah, you're joined at the hip and you can't really do anything.
Game design, 1993!
Yeah, you have no freedom whatsoever. And there's some arcane rules that decide which player control the camera, and I'm not sure if I understand them completely. It seemed to be that as Mario, I was mostly the character that the camera followed around. But then I think as we passed checkpoint flags or as we entered pipes, I think the first person would then take the lead, and you get a little triangle icon over the character's head showing that, oh, okay, this is the primary player and the other player should, you know, stick around this guy. And yeah, I don't know, like it's kind of confusing. It's really, I really found myself missing the ability to pick up the other player and throw him, you know, like it's not something that I usually do when I'm playing multiplayer on the console versions, but when your only choice in this really cramped area is to jump over the person or just try to bump into them, trying to get them to, like, to push them where you want them to go, you really feel like something is missing there. It is an inferior experience in every way.
I think you could butt stomp each other to switch control of the camera.
But, oh, really?
Why?
Yeah, so I think you can control it, but that also seems like it could happen by accident, or it could just lead to awful trolling in a game that is seems to be set up to be more cooperative than the console Mario games are.
Yeah.
You know, where those maybe are a little bit more competitive, with especially with having four people on there. But, yeah, it sounds like a really poor use of the technology that they have at hand.
The fact that you each have your own screen, yeah, actually...
This part doesn't make sense. It's not like there's one screen.
I could just picture myself, okay, like, I take the high road, I'm going to fly here, and you take the low road, and we're going to collect as many coins as we can in this level. That sounds fun. But, you know, like, I'm going to be the second player, and you're going to fly, and I'm not going to be able to follow you, and I'm going to fall off screen, and I'm potentially going to lose my power-up, and then I'm going to turn into a bubble while you're flying around and you're collecting coins. That's not fun.
I don't know. Yeah. That sounds like a blast.
Yeah, well, I guess they shoved it in at the last minute, but I haven't really heard anyone who likes it. I've only really heard bad things about it.
Yeah, I'm probably still going to play occasionally co-op just because it's, you know, it's a co-op game on the 3DS. I don't have many of those.
Right.
And it's still fun to an extent, but it doesn't mean that it's a good co-op game, if you know what I mean.
I mean, yeah. Disaster Day of Crisis is fun to an extent. It's not a good game.
Other than that, I during the holidays, I didn't really do much. I just have... I did look at my 4- and 7-year-old nieces try to play Mario for the first time. Their parents are very, very much not into video games and kind of against them. And so I think it was their first time trying to control Mario, and I...
You're corrupting them.
It
Good
was
job.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't think I have the patience to you know, assist someone who's still trying to learn, you know, how to use a D-pad. and with the 4-year-old one, at some point we just kind of reached like a kind of a cooperative effort where I would jump at the right times and she would just work the D-pad, but not very well. it wasn't that much fun for me. I don't know how much fun it was for her. Eventually, I just gave up and I turned on the camera app on the 3DS and I was like, okay, here's how you take pictures. Here's how you put the hearts all over mom and dad and have fun.
Kids love that stuff for real.
Yep.
They really do. All right, so I'll wrap up new business this week, and first up is a game that I was very highly anticipating called Fluidity Spin Cycle, sequel to one of my all-time favorite Wii games, period, much less WiiWare games, and that's the original Fluidity. You know, I have to say this game did not disappoint me. I know the opinions are a little mixed on it. Some people feel like it's a big step back from the first game, and I don't. I think it is a little bit different. But is mostly the same. It is mostly more Fluidity, which is totally fine with me. It has a few new ideas. It certainly has some fresh puzzles that sort of remix a lot of the mechanics that you've seen before. They maybe throw in a couple of things you haven't seen. But for the most part, the game plays just like Fluidity. And the kinds of levels you're going through, although they are broken up into chunks rather than, you know, have this giant sort of, you know, cartoon frame, like comic book frame, and you're going from one panel to the next and you're kind of exploring and trying to find the next rainbow drop. And this one, you know, you just open a stage and that stage has a rainbow drop and that is your goal. But along the way...
But that makes a lot more sense in a handheld.
It does. That's the thing. Like, you can complain about it. And I mean, I expected to be disappointed with that part, and in the end, I feel like it was probably the right decision because it does lend itself much more to a handheld. And frankly, although I love the exploration, I love the idea of going into a game world and not really knowing what to do next, you know, and kind of tooling around, and then you suddenly find something, or maybe you find three things, And it's this really exciting moment of discovery of, you know, I was kind of sort of just spinning my wheels, and then all of a sudden just have this breakthrough moment. I love that feeling. And you're not really going to get that with Spin Cycle, but a lot of people don't like that feeling. You know, a lot of people felt like the first Fluidity is a little bit too aimless. It doesn't give you enough guidance on what to do next. And if you don't really study the maps, and if you're not really keen on finding those secrets and the little passageways and the, you know, understanding how to use all the weird little physics toys that they stick in the levels, then you can get really frustrated with it. And I can appreciate that. I didn't, but I know that people did, people who are good at games. And I think this game for them will be a huge improvement. You know, and the other thing I would say is it's not like they've taken exploration out of the game. I mean, they still drop you into these levels, and there are 60 of them. So there's tons of content. As I would say, it's definitely a bigger game than the first one in terms of just the, you know, the square footage for you to play through. But they, within most of the levels, there are a couple that are very small and compact. They're more about solving this kind of intricate puzzle, and you can see most of it all kind of on one screen. But a lot of the levels have you going around and around, you know, different places. You kind of double back, you find a, you know, you open up a wall that lets you shortcut back to the beginning, but now you can turn into a new form, you can turn into the steam cloud over there, and now you can do something different. And so it still is the exploration concept, and there still is some backtracking, there still is puzzle solving, but it's all done on just a little more self-contained stage than it was in the first game. But to me, fundamentally, it's really not very different. It still has all the things that I liked in the first game. The graphics are really good. I mean, it's all 2D, sort of hand-drawn artwork, very colorful. You know, it's still the same kind of storybook presentation, and it looks really good. There's more little characters, more, you know, there's big dragons and things like that that there is kind of a small touch, but they're nice. They give it a little bit of a different feel than the first one. And, you know, I guess the main complaint that people have is about the spin levels. Because about 50% of the levels in the game are full circle spin levels, okay? So that means that that basically however you tilt the 3DS will be the new direction of gravity.
Right.
So if you rotate the thing all the way upside down, or if you just kind of tilt the whole thing forward, it's kind of like tilting, you know, it's kind of like holding a plate with a bunch of water on it. If you tilt it forward, the water's going to go in that direction.
If you flip it upside down, you just broke the plate.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You don't really have to turn the 3DS upside down. You really don't. They don't necessarily tell you that you can do this, but just like Billy described, you know, after he played this at PAX in September, you can just kind of tilt the whole system forward a little bit. You can still see it. In fact, you can also tilt the hinge up on the top screen, and you can see it perfectly if you want. And it doesn't take large movements to control the game. It's very precise. It's very sensitive, and you can play the game, you know, in general, without waving the system all over the place, without spinning it, without having to do things upside down. You really don't have to go through all that. And a lot of the levels, you know, they get pretty hard and they get pretty complicated. And sometimes they just become disorienting just because of the complexity of the level design. And I would not want to be spinning my 3DS on those levels. I think I would get really lost as to where I was and what I'm doing next and where is this, where is that. So I think kind of just really using it like a Wii remote, you know, just like in the first game, with a Wii remote, you're going to tilt it left or right to move left or right. But if you move forward, you're not going to spin the whole Wii remote upside down. You're just going to tilt it towards the TV a little bit. If you want to go down, you tilt it back towards yourself a little bit. And yes, this thing has a screen on it, but it's a good screen and it's not in 3D. So you don't have any kind of ghosting problems, and it's always easy to see. So you really don't have to have these dramatic movements with it. So the full gravity things, I would say, you know, in some ways they're a little more annoying to play just because they do require more motion from you, because now you can move in any direction and not just left and right. And so they're more physical to play, certainly, but they also allow for some different kinds of puzzles. And they're probably the main thing that differentiates Spin Cycle from the first Fluidity in a good way, because they allow the designers to put in different kinds of levels, different kinds of movement and exploration and puzzle solving that they couldn't have done without this mechanic. And there's also these kind of fossilized purple blocks that you sometimes will activate a thing in the wall that changes gravity for those blocks. So you always control the gravity of your water or your ice block or your steam cloud. And the little gears and other little puzzle pieces that are within the level, those also respond to your tilting. But there are these blocks that are more stationary, and you can move them around using these kind of gravity switches around the level. It's a little hard to explain. I think if you see it, it makes sense. But effectively, it really kind of makes for some puzzles that are probably even a little bit more towards the Zelda dungeon kind of paradigm than were in the first game. And the first game does have puzzles that kind of approach the kind of, you know, the Zelda feeling that you get in those games. But I think in this one, the puzzles are just a little more complicated, especially in those full tilt levels. And they're really good. Some of them are hard, you know, a lot of them, and they're not overly complex in that, you know, you're never dealing with like six different colors of gears or, you know, tons of levers and switches and stuff. It's usually, you know, there's never more than two or three different things you could try to do. And it'll become pretty evident pretty quickly, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And it's a matter of trying to do it in the correct order and, you know, just be logical about it. But I love that feeling. I love seeing these different pieces and thinking, I got to get this thing from A to B. And I can't approach it directly. I have to manipulate it by doing this other stuff and by tilting it. But then if I tilt it this way to get it where I want it, now I'm over there too. And I don't want to be over there because I have to be over here to get the switch. And so how do I deal with that? Well, if I turn into ice and stick to the wall before I tilt, then I tilt the gear, but I stay stationary. And then I can, you know, I mean, these are the kind of things that Fluidity.
Ice don't move, son.
Yeah. These are the kind of things that you get into with Fluidity. And the game ramps up really nicely. It doesn't hold your hand. It doesn't, you know, teach you a lot about these different mechanics. It just kind of introduces them slowly and lets you figure it out. And by the second or third world, I was fully in the swing of it. I mean, I was playing this game several hours a day on vacation. Did not get tired of it. I've beaten it now, probably put 20 hours into it.
Oh, nice.
For an eShop game, it's a big ass game. And it's really, really good. It's very polished. I really just don't have anything bad to say about it, except they got the bright idea to put boss battles in Fluidity. Now, I think there's a way to do this that could be a lot of fun.
Is it like sand? Do you erode it away?
No, it's this big monster, and you have to, like, you know, gather the water up and explode it on certain parts of it, and it's not the, I mean, it's ridiculous, but a lot of the stuff that goes on in the game is pretty loony. It's not out of character with the rest of the game. My problem is, it's an okay boss battle, and then they repeat it four times.
Good.
So there are four bosses in the game. They're all the same boss. They're different, slightly different variations of it. And, you know, it just brought me back to the whole Metroid Prime Hunters situation. Donkey Kong Jungle Beat's really bad about this. But even in those, at least there's more than one kind of boss, and they just repeat, you know, they kind of alternate back and forth. In this, there is exactly one boss. You beat the final boss almost the same way that you do the very first one. And it's just not that – it's really – I don't want to say lazy, but I mean, what are you thinking? If you're going to put bosses in the game, make bosses plural. Otherwise, this could have been just the final level. It could have just used the final version of it, the most difficult, complicated version, made that the very end of the game, and I would have been like, wow, cool, I wasn't expecting there to be a boss at the end of this game, but I did it, and it worked, and it was cool. But they introduce it so early in the game, they make you do it over and over again, it's just boggles the mind. I mean, if you can't come up with more than one boss idea, then don't put bosses in the game.
Or that's only put one boss in the game.
Yeah, I don't get it, because the rest of the game is so thoughtful and creative and innovative and polished. I don't understand how this made it through, but, you know, whatever. It's a very small part of the game. It just irked me so badly. It's a huge pet peeve of mine in video games when you repeat bosses. Other than that, I think, look, it's $11. if you like fluidity, you will love this. And if you never tried fluidity, I certainly think you should. You can still get the WiiWare demo. But this is an excellent game. I mean, there aren't very many 3DS games that use the motion control. And I think this one proves that 3DS motion control can be excellent. It's very, very faithful, very easy to use, easy to understand. I never had any problems with it whatsoever. Super impressed. And the only other game I really, only other new game I played very much of over the holidays, since I didn't have my Wii or Wii U with me. I beat Sticker Star, but I don't need to talk about that. But I did play some Wario Land 2. This came out on Virtual Console for 3DS right before I left for the holidays. And I probably would have played a lot more of it if Fluidity hadn't also come out halfway through the trip. But, you know, Wario Land 2, it's one of my favorite Game Boy games ever. One of the first that I ever had on my Game Boy Color. And it's a game that I think playing it again now, 10 years, you know, almost 15 years later from when I first played it, it reminded me that it's not the easiest, most accessible game. And the brilliance of Wario Land 2 is not apparent right off the bat. It feels like a kind of more refined version of the first Wario Land. And it may feel like that until you get all the way to the end. I mean, you've got the never dead kind of mechanic where you just sort of transform when you get hit by certain enemies. And that is certainly very interesting, but I think the whole map structure, the whole alternate secret exits, alternate endings, sort of completionist aspect of the game that makes it so addictive and so amazing once you realize that there's so much more to it than you first realized. You don't really get a glimpse of that until you've beaten it the first time. Then they give you the map, and then you can start playing through looking at the map, and you can actually see where all those branch off points happen. And that's when it really kind of dawns on you how complex and sophisticated this game is. And they did a better job of it in Wario Land 3, because there is actually an overworld map that I think you have right off the bat. And it's all a little more transparent. But in Wario Land 2, it feels like a really straightforward platformer, structurally at least, until you get to the end. And I made the mistake of, I thought I'd get all cute with myself, and so I just slept through the alarm in the first stage right off the bat. So I didn't even go through the main storyline or the main sequence of levels right off the bat. I went straight to one of the alternate sequences and endings, which is really hard. And I am pretty rusty on, you know, playing the game and the controls and how do you solve these puzzles. And it was kind of slow going getting through this alternate sequence of the game, just because you're not really supposed to play through that until you go through the main chunk of gameplay.
Yeah, so it's kind of those revelation moments when you realize, oh crap, I don't have to wake up at the beginning of the game. Yeah. And that opens up an alternate path. That's crazy.
And they never tell you that, but when you're looking at the map, you know, you play through that, you'll play through that game a couple times, or through that stage a couple times looking for a secret exit, and you can't find it. And you're like, the map says there is another way out of this level that leads to a whole other set of stages and a new ending. How am I supposed to get it? And finally, there's nothing left except to say, what if I just never wake up?
Well, isn't there like a kind of an icon or a drawing showing you potentially like the answer? Like, isn't it a kind of, you see the alarm clock going off?
I might have overlooked that. Yeah, I don't know. I might not have noticed that. But it's a very, very smart game. It's really fun. And if you like 2D platformers, especially kind of unusual 2D platformers that really try to do something different, that really reward lots of exploration and being very thorough, then you can't do much better than Wario Land 2. So I think it's a exceptional purchase for your 3DS. And that's all for new business this week. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a feature called A Night at the Symphony with Two Eyes by Andrew Brown. Love game music? You had better. Andrew curates a collection of his most beloved Wii soundtracks. And we've also got impressions of Tokyo Crash Mobs by Aaron Kaluska. This 3DS game, this game, what? Where am I? What is this? Oh god, this is Magnetica, but horrifying.
You mean magnificent, I believe. Haunting. The word you were looking for.
This is one of the weirdest things you'll ever see. Definitely go check it out. You have to read this.
We have a review, Fluidity Spin Cycle on the 3DS by Neil. I've always wondered why more 3DS games don't require me to turn the 3DS upside down. Now we know. Thankfully, the game's not all wet and still turns out okay. What? I did not write this pun.
Yo, why so many puns?
I'm sorry. We have impressions. Guxt on the 3DS by Aaron Kaluska. Cave Story creator Pixel has a new game, a vertical shooter, and Nicholas is bringing it to the 3DS. Video attached, showing of the side view mode.
What? Sorry, showing the side view mode. Literally, the 3DS is turned on its side to avoid the gap between the two screens.
Cool.
Wow.
We have another feature. Nintendo Collector... Yeah. We have another feature. Nintendo Collection... We have another feature.
I'm contagious, apparently.
My tongue is too big. We have another feature. Nintendo Collector's Journal by Justin Beru. Justin claims he'll collect, quote, about anything Nintendo related. He proves it with his method to counter the hurricane-addled shipment of Burger King Wii U toys. We also have a review mini of Cake Ninja 2 for the DSiWare by me. This is the first time we've mentioned it on the show, but Nintendo World Report has a new review format called the Review Mini. I didn't name it. Anyway, I reviewed Cake Ninja 2, an egregious duplication of Fruit Ninja, and it sucks badly.
All right, so be sure to check out all of this great original content, as well as pretty soon, I think, will be the top 10 games of 2012, according to the Nintendo World Report staff. Lots of features going up right now, so you'll find it all over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We're back for listener mail.
Take it away, James.
Nice. Oh, that's going to be the intro. Okay. First letter this week comes from Ryan in Anaheim, and he writes, "Rest in peace to my Wii U. Only a month old, and it's already pushing up daisies. The last thing I did before it mysteriously bricked itself was to send a friend request to Johnny. Coincidence?
No.
Seriously, this might go down as the worst Nintendo hardware ever. I had to send my Wii back to Nintendo 7 times. But at least I had it for 6 months before I got the video card rot the first time. While I'm sure the vast majority of Wii U owners have had no problems, it seems like I'm hearing about a lot of brick systems due to the update process being interrupted or the system being a good old-fashioned lemon. Every time I open my 3DS, I have to stare at two unsightly lines scratched down the top screen, and I'm hesitant to pick up a 3DS XL because I hear the screen scratching problem wasn't fixed. Can we finally declare an end to the era where Nintendo has a reputation for tough, reliable hardware?"
I liked when you were reading this that you gave the appropriate moment of silence after
reading it. I did. I'm glad someone realized that was a deliberate moment of silence. I would say the answer is no, because they still operate in a world where the 360 was a thing, and the PS2 was a thing, and the PS1 was a thing. I mean, comparatively, they do pretty well.
At least they haven't been hacked yet.
No. Well, 3DS.
They haven't given away all your credit card information.
Yeah, that's a true statement. So they didn't have to take down their online service such as it is for a month because they got hacked.
Well, not yet, anyway.
That's still one of some of my favorite episodes from RFN where we got status updates from John on the PSN. Hey, John, is PSN back yet?
No.
Okay. Back to the episode.
Well, you know, I've been bitten by this with Wii U, and I was pretty bitter about it, especially, you know, given that it happened on launch day. But here's the thing. I mean, yes, I think that Nintendo's hardware, you know, there were some problems with DS, and there's some problems with the original 3DS. Now, the XL, I haven't had any trouble with the screen. I never had screen scratching on my original 3DS. Maybe I didn't own it long enough to get there. But I did get those grease marks, you know, that would come up from the touchscreen. And with the XL, I don't even really have that. So I don't know. Maybe some people get a screen scratch because they carry it in some kind of case that compresses the system closed really tightly or something, and then it moves around. And I don't know, but I've had the XL for 6 months and I haven't had any trouble with that. So I think they did either fix that or at least make it less likely to happen. With the Wii U, you know, it is a very complicated system, and we've seen all three of the companies have hardware quality control issues as they've moved into the HD era. You know, the graphics cards are a lot more expensive and sensitive and complicated, and that seems to be the result, you know, the cause of a lot of the problems that all three systems are having. So I don't know if it's something that's going to get better over time, or maybe this is just the new reality, but sending your Wii back to Nintendo 7 times,
yeah,
Ryan,
I think that constitutes the worst Wii ever.
Well, that's probably not the same Wii. They probably sent him a new one at least 2 or 3 times during that process. So I have to wonder, what are you doing to it that is messing it up so bad? I'm not saying this has anything to do with your Wii U, but you might want to look at, you know, maybe turn the system off when you're finished with it, or check that it's getting a good power supply and that it's not in some 100-year-old outlet. I don't know, but that is very suspicious.
I have a launch day Wii U, and it runs like a champ.
I mean, I had my Wii crapped out once, but it wasn't the disc drive or anything else. It was just that the SD card drive was super slow and wasn't working very well.
You know, like the original 3DS, I did have the kind of scratch marks after a while. Like, it started with just grease marks. The bottom screen stamped on the top screen,
yep.
And then eventually it did become scratches. But the 3DS XL I've been carrying around, and I don't see any problems here. And I lent it to my nieces over the holidays, but maybe then, you know, maybe I'm just more cavalier with my hardware than some other people.
Guillaume walks into a room and chucks at the first person he sees.
Pretty much.
3D gaming! Foosh! Cavalier.
Well, you know, the good thing is that all this stuff is covered under warranty, and Nintendo has very good customer service in terms of replacing or repairing hardware that gets messed up. So, I think they do a good job of it. Now, I certainly wish they would prevent these things in the first place, but...
Sure. I mean, anything manufactured, anything at all, is going to have a certain number of faults. I mean, that is just reality.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think that any hardware that comes out now is going to be as resilient as some of the old hardware was. But that's really what the Nintendo stuff was known for. It was that you could beat the ever-living hell out of it and it would still be okay.
But well, that's until they started introducing moving parts, like
that's what I'm getting
at. Disc drives and hinges.
But
and,
yeah, you know. Now that it's – I mean, the original Game Boy was like thick plastic wrapped around a very simple chip with no moving parts whatsoever. Yeah, you could drop it. Whatever. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
You know, I think there's a certain amount of rose-colored glasses when people talk about this stuff, because the old Game Boy, the screens on it go really bad and they get blurry to the point that you can't really see what's happening anymore.
Oh,
and
I forgot my Game Boy so many times in the car under the hot sun, and that did, yeah, that ravaged the that Matrix screen.
Sure. Sure it did.
And Bonker, I know, just get lines.
N64 joysticks lose tension over a couple of years and become very difficult to use, to say the least.
And the way that the NES is designed, of course, means that at some point the connectors won't connect anymore.
Well, that would apply to the Super Nintendo as well, because it's the same basic principle. It's still metal on silicon connectors, I mean.
Yeah, but I meant more with the whole spring thing.
Oh, that, and, yeah. That,
you know, that went bad really, really quickly, and people, that led to millions and millions of people blowing into their cartridges when they really shouldn't.
Yeah. Hey, the Super Nintendo plastic turns yellow over time.
It's kind of a drab, ugly color from the 70s. It's impressive, to be honest.
Yeah. Show me someone who has, you know, like basically perfect condition Nintendo consoles from more than 10 years ago. And I guarantee they just, because they never really played them. or they, you know, they went to outlandish measures to try to care for them, you know, clean them constantly and stored them away from direct sunlight and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, unfortunately, these are consumer electronics. They're things that you put your hands on. They're things that you move around. They're things that kids get into. And there are things that you spend hundreds, thousands of hours using. Over time, they will break down. I mean, I can appreciate, you know, you just bought a new system. It's less than 2 months old and it stops working. That is incredibly frustrating because it's almost certainly not anything that you did to it. But over time, these things break down. And, you know, this whole thing about tough, reliable hardware, maybe the newer systems are less reliable than the old ones, or at least they're less robust, yeah. But they also do so much more. You know, those old systems didn't have disk drives. They didn't have wireless antennas. They didn't have touch screens. So you can't expect them to maintain exactly the same quality controls. In some ways, they're better. In some ways, they're worse.
Yeah, it's really hard to make a product that's totally robust. I mean, a great example of – well, it's a side. We won't go too far into that. I mean, but it's – well, it is kind of amazing the kind of abuse a GameCube can take, I will admit, considering it's got moving parts in it. But its complexity, like Johnny said, is even though it's not that much less powerful than the Wii, I mean, it's significantly less powerful, it just does a lot less stuff.
Well, and it has more, you know, it has more room, so everything is spaced out a little bit more. There's more space for cooling. And the other thing is the GameCube, because it was their first disk drive system, I bet you that they over-designed the hell out of that disk drive.
Probably.
To make it super robust, you know.
And super tiny.
Yeah. Whereas the Wii actually takes two different sizes of disks, which means it effectively has two different like motors and laser arms on it, I think. I think that's why if you ever turn on a Wii without a disc in it, you'll hear it spin at two different rates, and that's because it's testing for two different sizes of discs.
The more you know.
So that thing's going to fail more often than a GameCube disc drive that only takes one kind
of
disc.
Well, and the GameCube disc drive also, it just sat on a spindle. It wasn't one of those slot loaders, which makes a big difference.
That's right, yeah. It was simpler design. But it took up a lot more vertical room.
The one point that was in the letter that we've already talked about, but the whole having to update the system thing was mostly, I think, a launch mistake from Nintendo. They should have really flashed the firmware update.
Oh, God, yes.
So they should really have planned better for that, and it's entirely their fault if people are breaking their Wiis by stopping the endless update.
It does warn you pretty thoroughly, though. Hey.
Yeah, well, I don't know. People get impatient.
Well, the reason people are unplugging it is because the download gets stuck 2 hours into it and doesn't seem to be making any progress. And they're like, "What do you want me to do here?"
Wait. Yeah.
And they push the buttons on the system and nothing happens. And finally, they're like, "I guess I'm just going to unplug it because nothing else. I don't have any other options here." And for some people, that works. And for some people, it bricks their system.
Well, it depends on how far it is. If you're just downloading, yes. I think you're okay. If you're not just downloading, if you're installing, you done screwed up, son.
Yep. Exactly. And there's really not a good way to tell. So it's partly Nintendo's fault for not having the online infrastructure to get that stuff out there and for delivering too large of a firmware update in one go. You know, if they had done that stuff piecemeal, you know, like... you know, let's break it up into three pieces, and you can't download the second one until you've downloaded and already installed the first one. And so we keep the download smaller, and you have to come back and do it multiple times, but there's so much less likelihood of this thing getting hung up and of it taking so long for people to download it. That's what I would have done, but, you know, whatever. They learned their lesson. They're paying the cost. Trust me. They won't do it again.
Yeah, they will.
At least for 4 or 5, 6 years.
They will totally do that shit again.
Okay, so Guillaume has the next letter.
Cliff writes, "So Wii U is closing in on 2 months old, and the eShop hasn't had a single new game to come out for it. I thought that by now they would be releasing some Wii U Virtual Console titles that they had held back for these slow periods. I hope I'm wrong, but at this point, I don't think that the Virtual Console service will be announced until E3. Why do you think that Nintendo has decided not to hold back a few games, be it Virtual Console, Indie Game, or Small Studio Nintendo game, to make it feel like the eShop isn't dead? Do you think this hurts the image of Nintendo's Wii U?"
Because the eShop is dead.
Well, they didn't hold anything back because they don't have anything to hold back.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo didn't make the stuff in the eShop, so they would have had to be telling a third party, just hold on.
Yeah, and I think that the indies would have rebelled at the thought that, like, if they were ready to go, if their game was ready to go, they wanted it at launch, because that's when the money is getting made. And I guess Nintendo would have to compensate them somehow for, you know, like, if they willingly pushed back the release.
Yeah, and that's not really Nintendo's thing.
Yeah, like the cases that I can think of Nintendo actually pushing back a release would be for something like Fluidity Spin Cycle, where they publish it themselves.
I mean, if for Nintendo to hold something back, it would need to be something relatively significant, because is anybody really going to be super excited because they held back the release of a game where you burn kids in a school bus? No, not really. Not going to move the needle.
I think they're lucky they got that game out before certain other events
occurred.
They're lucky that hasn't blown up into some weird controversy.
By the way, if people are confused, it's because I edited something out of... I edited myself out completely when I talked about Little Inferno.
Oh, that's right.
Never mind.
Yeah, Little Inferno's got some fucked up shit in it. But, you know, there were 4 eShop games on launch, which is really good. Really good.
And 2 of them are ports. Let's be clear. 3DS ports. The eShop games. 2 of them are 3DS ports. Right?
Well, okay.
Yeah.
That's true.
Mighty Switch Force and...
Oh, yeah. Mighty Switch Force. That's the other one.
Yeah.
But I think the other games just aren't done yet. And I think Nintendo is probably... I think Nintendo will release some, like, smaller, cheaper eShop games, you know, eShop exclusive games in the future, but that was never a big priority for them on WiiWare. You know, they didn't release any first party stuff, for a long time. I mean, they had Pokemon Ranch or whatever the fuck that was. It's not even really a game. And then I think it was a long time before they published anything else on WiiWare. They really wanted that to be a space for smaller studios to play, you know, and to own. And maybe they're kind of sticking with the same thing. On eShop, they've done a little bit better balanced job. So there's been some of their own stuff, and there's been some really good third-party stuff. But it took a while for that to happen. I mean, you got to remember the eShop wasn't even around when 3DS launched. It took 4 months. Was it three? No, three
something
months.
Something like that, yeah.
It three
took
months
a, it
before
took a
they even
long
launched it.
Amount of time, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's also a, I think there's also, well, let me put it this way. If I was an independent developer making a Wii U eShop game, I would not want to release it the last week of December.
No.
Because for one thing, that eShop is already really crowded. It's got a lot of retail games. It's got, well, it's got at least one demo so far.
It's got two demos.
It's got lots of advertisements for things that aren't actually sold through the eShop. And it's got a lot of, you know, pretty big upfront promotion for the 4 games that were there on launch day.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about the launch period is you've got a lot of people getting it on the first day, and they're immediately looking for things to download. And so they had something to choose from, you know, right off the bat. But then all the other systems that were sold in November and early December are for Christmas presents or Hanukkah presents, and they don't get open until later in the month. And so when those people, you know, kids or family members or wives or husbands open their new systems, they're going to turn it on, and they've still got those same 4 games that are brand new to them. So adding a 5th one to it really doesn't get you very much attention. I think it's smart for Nintendo or the developers or whoever is kind of deciding to not rush this stuff out to market. I think it's smart to wait until the first 1 or 2 weeks of January to release this stuff, because then you can actually get a little bit more attention for it. People are actually at home, and they're actually, you know, they've got their eShop gift cards or whatever, and they're looking for stuff to buy.
Well, and well, first off, Christmas is on a Tuesday, and Nintendo's rules, so all these games come out on Thursday for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But on top of that, people, when you buy someone a game console, you usually buy them at least one game. So people are going to be somewhat occupied for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a certain logic in it. Now, in terms of the virtual console, which we haven't really touched on, I just don't think Nintendo has a virtual console strategy in place for the Wii U yet.
I think they're probably working on something, but Cliff mentioned, you know, maybe it'll be announced at E3. I think that's a good prediction.
I think there was an expectation that the eShop would have a stronger start just because the system seems to be so similar to the hardware already out there with Microsoft and Sony. And perhaps people were expecting to get some of these downloadables day and date with the XBLA and PSN versions. But then again, you know, like it, as similar as the hardware seems to be, there are challenges when you develop for it. And we also, like, do we have some idea of the number of development kits that are out there in the hands of independent developers?
No, but I think the limiting factor here is not the number of development kits. It's the manpower at these small development studios. Hmm. So they're, you know, they can't just easily add on another port to a game that they're already almost finished working on. It would have had to been planned far in advance, like with Runner 2.
To be honest, there aren't a lot of XBLA or PSN games coming out at the moment either.
Especially ones that aren't exclusive. Right. So a lot of the things that are released on Xbox and PlayStation as digital-only games are published by Microsoft and Sony.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There, I mean, XBLA has been somewhat of a wasteland for the last month or so. I mean, there's been a couple things, but it's been...
Since the summer of Arcade.
Yeah, it's been pretty quiet. I mean, I don't follow the PSN, obviously, but... If you want to get new content on XBLA, you got to go to the Indie Arcade, at which point, just don't do it. Just don't.
Stuff in there, but it's hard to find.
There is some tremendous stuff in there, if that's what you're looking for. Poorly drawn anime dating sims. There you go. Yes! XBLA Indie Arcade, just for you.
There are lots of those, yes.
Starring zombies and massage functionality.
But I think it'll get better. I mean, trust me, right now people are playing their Zombie U and their Nintendo Land and their Mario, but when it comes February and there ain't jack shit coming out for Wii U, you will be so glad to have Runner 2 releasing in that time frame, and it'll be brand new to you.
Yep.
So, I don't know exactly when that game's coming out, but that sounds like a good bet. You've got the Mutant Muds Deluxe Edition coming out around the same time frame. Cloudberry Kingdom is still... TBD, I guess, but...
It's still a thing, as far as we know.
Oh, they're definitely still making it, and that game is awesome. It's one of the most fun games I played in 2012, but it's not going to be on my top game of the year list because it was a beta, but it's fantastic, and that's something you can really look forward to. So, there's a lot of stuff coming. I would say, if you're complaining about the lack of eShop stuff, and you haven't played Trine 2 yet... Get on that, man. That game is awesome. And I haven't played the Wii U version because I already beat it on Steam, but I've heard nothing but great things about it on Wii U, and they're working on a patch to make it even better. And it's gorgeous, super fun, awesome 2D platformer, lots of stuff to do in there. Just great, you know. So there's a lot of stuff on there, but, there's also a lot of retail games you can download. So if you're willing to spend a little bit more... And Sonic Racing is only $40. It's not, it's twice Trine 2, but it's still a lot less than...
It's Trine 4.
Yeah, that's right. Sonic Racing All-Stars Transformed is Trine 4. So the last email is from Evan B. No, not that Evan B.
Because he lives in a shed.
A different one.
In the wilderness.
Evan says... You guys are right. The last story is just so damn good. But was I the only one that got a bit of a Zelda vibe from the game? I feel its unique strategy portions, especially in relation to defeating the bosses, vibrant cast of characters, and save the princess feeling of the story really contributed to this. And let's be honest, Zangarak, the antagonist, looks a bit too much like Ganondorf to be denied. It struck me so profoundly because the last story is great. Genuinely, awesomely great. It strays from just as many JRPG staples as it embraces, and focuses on a small-scale conflict, but if the main character simply had a few name switches and more motion control had been implemented primarily in aiming, this game would undoubtedly rock the traditional Zelda formula to its core, while also succeeding extremely well, in my opinion. Would a Zelda game with some or maybe all of the last story's elements have truly given us an unforgettable experience, or would you prefer a more traditional title like Skyward Sword?
So, I actually played these games relatively back-to-back,
One thing that I've always wondered about them putting in another Zelda game, and this would be, this is what to me makes the Last Story's combat different, is Link is all by himself all of the time. And in the Last Story, you are never by yourself. That's one of the core conceits of the gameplay.
There's nothing tactical about Zelda combat.
No. I mean, it's a lot about managing the interplay between the party members.
Mm-hmm.
To really adopt Last Story stuff, they would have to break the boundary of Link being able to do it all on his own. They'd really have to give him someone to work with. And you could do interesting things with gameplay puzzles and coming up with combat ideas and figuring out how to do that. But it would be a relatively big divergence.
Well, they've dabbled in it. Like, you know, with Zelda helping in Ocarina of Time in the final battle. And with Wind Waker 2, she does that.
Yeah, but Wind Waker, she's just as likely to hit you sometimes.
Well, you've got the, you know, using the statue and...
Yeah, that's actually more interesting to me as a statue. I would think, though, to really get that same vibe, they would have to have a consistent character that's with you throughout the game.
Who actually has AI and is not someone you drew a line to tell them where to go.
Right. Or just shooting arrows at the enemy constantly.
Yeah.
While standing perfectly still.
But I mean, they've gone enough in that direction that I think it wouldn't be totally shocking if they ever...
I think they would have to redesign a lot of parts of the game. They'd really, like, that second character or third character or whatever would have to factor into solving the puzzles in the dungeon.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd have to have some reason to be working with them besides, let's all go fight Ganondorf. Like, there'd have to be a real reason why that other person is there.
Well, and Mike Sklins is somewhere right now screaming about Prince of Persia, but he's right. I mean, Prince of Persia Sands of Time did a really nice job of this, where you had a character who was sort of your companion through most of the game, and it factored into the combat, and it factored into the puzzle solving and the exploration, and especially the story. And
really allies. You were pretty antagonistic in most of the Prince of Persia games where you had you were less antagonistic than the people you were killing, but but the two of you weren't friends.
Not for most of it.
No.
And that's part of what made it fun. And you know, that kind of speaks to the problem here and the reason that I'm afraid Nintendo would never go in this direction is that it would require Link to actually interact with other characters in a meaningful way.
Right.
And he just doesn't do that. And the only time they've really even tried to do that, to make Link kind of show emotion and have some kind of deep relationship with other characters, was in, like, Twilight Princess with that girl in the village, and it was awful.
What do you mean? I really believed in their relationship, and then the game forgot about it for 80 hours.
If they're going to do that stuff, they've really got to commit to it.
So the only other one I could think of where he had any interaction whatsoever was Link's Awakening. And that was obviously presented in a very, you know, early 90s gaming sort of way. But at the very least, he interacted with Marin to an extent that he doesn't with anyone else.
I think for
that series, that's about as far
as... I think the whole relationship between Link and Marin is overblown in people's nostalgic memories.
No, I understand that. But for this series, that's about as far as they've gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I would say in Twilight Princess, it's even less than that because, like Guillaume said, after 80 hours, or he forgot that she even exists until you're having to tackle Ganondorf Yak later. Oh, yeah, I did this shit already. Oh, my God. Really?
I've played neither game, so I can't really speak to this. This will come up, I'm sure, during the Majora's Mask episode, but I am entirely in favor of shaking up the formula because it's not doing it for me at all. Skyward Sword just lost me so fast. Okay, I won't spoil the surprise too much right now, but Majora's Mask is not really my cup of tea either, and perhaps not even Ocarina of Time. So, I don't know. Change it up. I don't care.
Guillaume hates Zelda, confirmed.
Yeah, basically Guillaume is saying if he were given the chance of helping Link from falling to his death or kicking him off the cliff, he'd be stomping on those fingers.
Well, to me, like the strongest that this franchise has ever resonated with me was with Link's Awakening. And it's never really recaptured that. Granted, I didn't own an N64, so perhaps like the momentous release that was Ocarina of Time was kind of a product of its time and kind of lost on me. when I played it after the fact, because the game was not so technically impressive anymore, and because perhaps it had already been copied a little by the time I played it. But yeah, the formula is not really doing it for me. I think that a lot of the things that worked in 2D, such as well, item hunts and things like that, don't work so well in 3D. And everything seems to be taking so much more time than it does in 2D. Talking to characters, exploring towns, I find that so tedious in the 3D games. And, you know, in the 2D games, the ones that do have village in them, you're done so quickly. I like my games a little bit snappier than the 3D Zeldas have been.
Okay.
Guillaume wants a 10-hour Zelda game.
Ah, oh, that would be fantastic.
You get off this podcast right now.
I'd be all in favor of that if they designed the game around that kind of experience and it didn't just feel like they quit early, you know, and just kind of chopped it off.
But you'll
get no argument from me on Skyward Sword. That game is too long. It is absolutely too long.
Oh yeah, and the stuff they put in there to make it longer just doesn't fit. It's just there. We had this debate almost a year to the day ago where we went item by item and said, well, that makes the game superficially long and is stupid. That shouldn't be here. And then we went on the 10-minute tirade about the underwater item quest or the fishes, finding the glowing fucking fishes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Evan is right to say that Skyward Sword is a more traditional game. But it is very innovative in a lot of ways, too, just to give it due credit. You know, I think that what it does with motion control is easy to overlook by the time you've played it for 50 hours because it's sort of become natural by that point. You don't really have to think about it nearly as much, and so it just that's just how you play that game. But other games don't play like that, and it is very special in that way. But, you know, the last story, I think... You know, I think these comparisons, a lot of them are a bit superficial between The Last Story and a Zelda game.
Although Zangorak does freaking look like Ganondorf from Twilight Princess. I mean,
but it's superficial. I mean, he looks like him.
Oh no! And, I mean, I'm agreeing. It is superficial, but he really looks like him.
Oh, absolutely, he does. Yeah, and you know, I noticed it too. But I think you can probably get carried away with the comparison.
Oh, yeah.
I think on a deeper level, they're extremely different games, and. Yeah, I think Zelda could probably learn something from The Last Story, but I think Zelda can learn something from a lot of games right now. Zelda is so insular and focused on itself and sort of trying to refine what it already does. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot, so we're not going to regurgitate it, but I don't think The Last Story has any more to offer the Zelda franchise in terms of inspiration than a lot of other games do. But, you know, modernize Zelda. Yes. And I mean, that is one of the great things about The Last Story is that it's a kind of game you've probably played before, but it's so different. It's so streamlined and innovative and clever and fast paced and short compared to other Japanese RPGs.
Yeah, it's pretty short.
That it really does come across as being extremely fresh in a genre that people think of as being stale and stuck in the 90s. So, you know, I think Final Fantasy could learn a lot more from The Last Story than Zelda could.
Well, it might want to learn to be a little less linear after 13, but...
No, I don't know. I mean, I think Last Story proves that you can make a really good linear Japanese
but they don't,
RPG.
To an
There's
extent.
A way to do it, and it's not Final Fantasy 13, which is a game I like, but I like it in spite of itself in a lot of ways.
All right, I'm giving you a long leash here, game.
Yep.
But stop it.
You know, it's Final Fantasy. I mean, I truly do have a soft spot for Final Fantasy. I bought a game that involves kind of tapping on the screen to Final Fantasy music.
Yep.
Because I like Final Fantasy.
You and a lot of people. That game, jeez.
That game sold a lot of copies, man. It's really good.
And a lot of DLC.
Anyway, we're going to talk more about Theatrhythm and Last Story and a lot of this other stuff coming up in a couple episodes. So, next week, we're going to have John back. We're planning to do our predictions for 2013. We're going to review the predictions from last year.
They were not
good.
Which
should be fairly hilarious. James has been dredging those up and summarizing them for us.
Dredging is the right word.
Yeah. We're gonna lay out a few new goose eggs for 2013 that you can laugh about, and maybe get you a little bit excited about some things that might happen. And so hopefully John's gonna participate in that next week, and then the plan is the week after that we're gonna do our top five lists, top five games of 2012. And they're going to be very personal lists. We'll each have our own. We'll talk about why this game really worked for us. Some of them may be games that we didn't even talk about that much on the show, but, you know, or maybe one person did a lot of it in New Business. The other person kind of played it quietly, but liked it even more and just never really came up. So I think there'll be some surprises on there. I expect my list is going to have some surprises for people, but I've got some catching up to do as well. I got to play a lot more of The Last Story and a few other things.
Yep.
But I'm looking forward to that very much. And then by the end of January, we will have our live Majora's Mask retroactive. Woo! So I'm not totally sure how we're going to handle the recording for that week, but we'll figure it out coming up. It's a 2 or 3 weeks away.
So get playing.
Just make
Majora's
sure you
Mask.
Keep playing the game if you haven't started already. This is definitely the time to start. It's not a short game. There's a lot to see and do. It might take a little while to get going on it, but it's very worthwhile. So we're going to do that soon, and as always, we appreciate everyone who wrote in. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, or go to the show notes over at the website and click on the link there as well.
Speaking of the website, Johnny, go ahead. I'll let you do it.
No, I'll let you do it.
Oh, okay, fine. Speaking of the website, we have a new, I'm not sure how you want to describe it, a magazine-like production called Nintendo World Report Powered Off, which is a compilation of some of the best content from the site. In this case, it was over the course of the last few months, where it has been compiled into a magazine-style format. And very proud of the work of mine that got mentioned in there. It is the ultimate work of trolling the site has ever seen. I'm very pleased with this. This is going to be a monthly adventure that our staff will be taking on. It's not just going to be content regurgitated from the site. There's going to be new content created specifically for that format, and there's going to be letters, and it's a really neat project that some of our staff took on their own, and we're really happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, it's a digital magazine, so it's in PDF. You just download it, and then you can read it, you know, even when you're not connected to the internet. But it's laid out like a really nice magazine. Mm-hmm. It looks like pages from Nintendo Power, which is impressive as hell. And
It's very slick.
Yeah, it looks really great, and it's an exciting project. So if you're really bummed out about the end of Nintendo Power, maybe this will fill in one of the quadrants of your empty heart.
Yep. We're also going to be featuring content from the site's history that is of note, to use the correct way of putting it. It may not necessarily be the best content, but it may be the most noteworthy. I'm looking forward to reviews of Lowly Golf 2 showing back up in one of these issues.
Mm. All right. So that's going to do it for this episode of Radio Free Nintendo. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week as a foursome. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Miss you, John.
God, come back.
John hasn't listened to a single episode since he left.
Has he? Are you sure?
I'm just guessing he hasn't.
Guessing. I'm curious. I wonder about that.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.